From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I mean, I would direct an Indiana Jones right now, you know. I would love the opportunity. Like, no one questions it when a guy directs women. But I have, to my face, been questioned about directing men.
Elizabeth Banks is a member of a still-too-small Hollywood club, Women Who Make Big Studio Movies. After directing Pitch Perfect 2 and a Charlie's Angels reboot set for release this fall, Banks has even bigger ambitions. This week, we're revisiting our conversation with Banks. She tells us about getting bored with acting and moving into producing and directing. Despite the industry-wide talk of opening opportunities for women, she's still run up against some very closed minds. But first on the news banter, a new chairman at Warner Brothers, although it's not so clear what it means right now to be the chairman of Warner Brothers. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am back from a long trip and joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. Welcome back.
Thank you. So, big changes while I was gone at Warner Brothers. We know there was a crazy guessing game going on as to who would become chairman of Warner Brothers, replacing Kevin Sugihara, who, as we know and as we reported, resigned in a misconduct scandal. So the answer finally came, and this was actually kind of almost hilarious. There was a view, which turned out to be correct, that they were going to hire a woman because they're a little thin in the ranks that way. So everybody who is a woman sort of became a potential name in this game of guessing. And the person who got the job is Anne Sarnoff. And she is a person, I think I can safely say, that many of my sources in the business who have been in the film business or for quite a long time have never heard of.
No, she doesn't have a profile in Los Angeles in the Hollywood community, but she has a pretty impressive resume when it comes to a diversity of background. She worked at Nickelodeon. She worked at BBC and was instrumental in a streaming service. She has experience at the WNBA. She's on the board of PayPal, which gives her a little digital media experience. The one thing she doesn't have in her background is film experience. And now she's going to be running Warner Brothers, one of the most iconic film studios going back, you know, almost 100 years.
Yeah, I think that has been baffling to people I've talked to. You know, this town has a very strong specific culture, which is generally hostile to outsiders. Now, it's not even clear, what does it mean to be chairman of the Warner Brothers film and TV studio? AT&T has bought what is now called Warner Media. They seem to be very focused on things, the crown jewel being HBO. They are starting their streaming service. It really does feel like the movie business is becoming a much smaller cog in the machine. Although I would argue that movies still have a profile and still make certain kinds of properties really seem important. And if they do end up on your streaming service, you see Netflix starting to put movies in theaters more and more because I think it still does matter.
Yeah, and if you see what Disney has done in the film business, they've really been the standard setter for the last few years. And they are producing the kinds of movies that are still demanded by audiences to see in theaters. And the Warner Brothers studio has plenty of franchises. They have a bunch of things that can be exploited and in some ways is already being exploited by the film studio. But this is going to be a real challenge for this new CEO of Warner Brothers, is what does a film studio look like and how does it operate in 2019 and beyond? As far as the culture goes, Anne Sarnoff did an interview with Hollywood Reporter in which she was asked about the culture of Warner Brothers and how she planned to put her stamp on that culture. She really just talked in generalities, said she wants to be collaborative. She wants to be respectful of talent. You know, these are all things you're supposed to say. But I think it's a big question as to whether someone from the outside can come into a studio like Warner Brothers and be effective as a leader.
Yeah, and I kind of am trying to find a diplomatic way to say that John Stankey, who is an AT&T guy who now runs Warner Media, feels very much like a guy who deals with guys more than with ladies. And he hired Bob Greenblatt to run the streaming service in HBO in this big content job. And it feels that that's his hire. And it feels a little bit more like he was pushed into filling the female slot there. And Warner's, I have to say, that studio has been a boys' club for a long time. It will be a tremendous challenge, I think, for Anne Sarnoff to come in there and establish herself. And, you know, she is very well regarded by people who know her and have worked with her. But I'm going to say that it's going to be a challenge. Let's just leave it at that. And, you know, as we're talking about all of this, I will mention, you know, we have seen a summer where the box office has not been super peppy up until now. We had Spider-Man in theaters this weekend, and we don't know the numbers as we're talking now, but they look, it's off to a strong start. But this has been tough, not just for the most studios who aren't Disney, but for theaters. The Bloomberg just had a piece talking about how difficult this has been for AMC. Its stock is down 25% year to date. And given that valuation, the company is, as Bloomberg points out, worth barely more than the $835 million it paid to acquire Carmike Cinemas 3 years ago. That's pretty drastic.
Yeah, and it reflects a number of things that are bad for theaters right now. First of all, the box office is being dominated by one studio, Disney. And what that does, it gives Disney more leverage to negotiate with the theaters. Typically, you saw a 50-50 split in the U.S., movie studio and theater, between the box office revenue. But with Disney, they have all of these huge franchises. They can go in and get a better percentage of the box office returns for those movies. And that's something that would hurt the chains. The other thing is the future of releases. I mean, this is supposed to be the biggest year ever for Hollywood. The predictions were all that 2019 was going to be the peak of Disney's dominance and all these franchises and all these other movies that were coming out. Next year and even beyond look decidedly weaker, at least for now, in terms of the releases set for the calendar. So I think what the stock market is seeing is into the future, the theater business is going to become much more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the studios need to mix it up a little bit more or find a way to get the audiences in the chairs. And of course, I always hear complaints about the quality of the theaters. And I know that they've made efforts to address that. But so far, I guess not really working. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the Hunger Games movies, Elizabeth Banks's pink-haired character, Effie Trinket, had a memorable catchphrase.
Happy Hunger Games, and may the odds be ever in your favor.
In real life, the odds weren't in Banks's favor as she turned her attention to producing and directing. After playing roles in Wet Hot American Summer, Spider-Man, Seabiscuit, and The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Banks was ready to expand her portfolio. Her company produced the sleeper hit, Pitch Perfect, and she ended up directing the sequel. More recently, she launched the new Hulu series Shrill, based on the Lindy West memoir of the same name. And she co-wrote and directed a Charlie's Angels reboot that will be out in the fall. That track record puts her in an elite group of women hyphenates making big commercial projects. Even before Banks really got started in the business, it seems clear she had her eyes on the prize. When you were still in school studying, you were offered a soap. Decided not to do it.
Yes. That happened when I was in graduate school. I got my MFA at ACT in San Francisco in acting, and we did our showcase in New York about a month and a half before graduation, and I got offered a soap opera after that, and it would have meant leaving school before I graduated and making this huge decision about the next 2 years of my life when I had landed in New York 2 days before. And I just thought, I'm not ready to make this kind of decision, even though financially it would have been a great decision.
Right, right. Well, so many people would have been like, this is such an uncertain profession, I'll take the money.
Absolutely. And also, it was the first time that I realized that the goalposts can constantly move in terms of what I think of as success for myself. And so I thought, I've been in New York for 2 days and I already have a soap opera, a 2-year contract. What can I get tomorrow?
you're taking an upbeat view of things, like something good, something better.
Maybe something else will happen. Let's see.
So you stayed with it. It obviously worked out eventually.
Eventually, yeah.
And I guess at that point, though, you start to sort of get into this place where you say you were a frustrated and bored actress.
Yeah. You know, I got really good advice from Laura Linney about working in the business, and she was concerned about being profoundly bored. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, you do sort of start to see patterns in the roles. You know, it's changing now. I think it is getting a little bit better. But at the end of the day, you play a lot of wives and mothers and girlfriends, and you're always sort of servicing someone else's story. So it was really about how do I find ways to tell a story where I have agency
You also said, I'm not turning into Reese Witherspoon.
Well, that would be impossible.
Because... Right. You could not be, because she is Reese Witherspoon.
She is one of a kind.
Right. But I think what you were talking about was that the opportunity to become that kind of star.
Oh, yes. I think life is... It really is a lot about timing. And I grew up on rom-coms and I loved rom-coms and I thought I was very well suited to rom-com and would have loved to have played a romantic lead in a comedy movie. And that has only happened to me really only once in Zach and Mary Make a Porno for Kevin Smith. And that was an incredible experience. I bawled my eyes out at the end of shooting that movie because I really felt that it had never been as good for me as an actor. I had not ever been that fulfilled, and I knew that it was going to be rare and probably not going to happen again. Mm. And it never has. So I got to do it exactly really one time.
I think you're our only guest that I know of that was nominated for Best On-Screen Kiss.
Yeah.
But that was with Mark Wahlberg. But yes, that was not a romantic lead, I guess. I can't even remember what the movie was.
It was for Invincible.
Okay.
Yeah, which is a nice sports movie about Vince Papale.
Okay.
Yeah, Philadelphia Eagle.
But it was not the kind of, I mean, not, I'm not, we don't have to talk about that specific role, but I'm just saying, we're not asking you to bag on the on-screen thing with Mark Wahlberg, but it just.
The on-screen kissing of Mark Wahlberg was pretty great and did lead to a nomination. I don't think I won. I have three popcorns from the MTV Movie Awards.
Okay.
That's about all I have in the business.
Oh, okay. But you've got nominations, though. So you're unrecognized. But there's not that rom-com thing where you get to be.
They sort of stopped making them. I came up with like Paul Rudd and those guys. And then, Paul and Seth, who we're speaking about right now, ended up sort of in these bromancy movies, right? Where everything was about two guys. I mean, I'm in Role Models, which is one of them. And the women took a back seat. The romantic female lead kind of took a back seat to a lot of guys. And then I didn't get a couple movies. Like, I wanted to be in Knocked Up, and I'm not in Knocked Up. I wish I was, but...
They probably wish you were, too.
I don't know about that, but
I said it. You didn't. Successful movie. Thank you.
It's a very successful But, you know, movie. Those opportunities, like, I didn't get them. I have failed many times. I have had to overcome lots of no in the
business. It's part of the deal, right?
Yeah. There's only so many roles, and
I'm going to read you your own words again because I thought they were so good. So you had noticed that people like Paul Rudd and Bradley Cooper were getting 70% more at bats than you did.
Yes,
and you say he has that many, and you're talking specifically about Paul Rudd, who is Ant-Man. He has that many more chances to improve his quote, and that business of improving the quote, of course, is something that contributes to.
Absolutely. I mean, that's all about pay equity and how we have a system that works against women from the very beginning, you know, because we don't have as many opportunities. I mean, I think last year, that number really hasn't changed, that 70-30 ratio of male to female roles in the major motion pictures, right? So 70% of roles are played by men and only 30% are played by women. So, you know, all of the guys have way more opportunities, or at-bats, as I like to say. And at a certain point in my career, I had to realize that it wasn't that I wasn't good enough to be cast. It was that there just literally weren't as many opportunities for me and all of the amazing actresses that I love and adore in this business. And I don't even like to say the word compete with, but that's truly, we are being pitted against each other for these very few jobs.
Right.
And once you really realize it was a numbers game as much as anything, I just thought, I don't want to be up against that. I need to take more control over what I'm doing with my time and how I'm spending it.
Yeah, there's this thing where you consult, I guess. You mentioned Laura Linney, Frances McDormand, Diane Lane, Julianne Moore. And they're telling you, like, great roles for women in indie films. And you're sort of like, yeah, I know. No, thank you.
I have been in many independent films. And you have an opportunity every once in a while to change your life, but it's usually about a role that wins you accolades. And, you know, I'm a mother of two young children, and this is my time to be a breadwinner. And I feel like doing independent film and going to the Sundance Film Festival and doing that circuit, I've done this many, many times. It has not changed my life. It has not bought me a house. And it hasn't gotten me an Oscar either.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, again, these are the things you're balancing as a woman who's over 40 in Hollywood. Like, your choices are so limited in terms of what you can do. And so, yeah, I'm just choosing to try and to play in the bigger leagues and where I can actually make money for the same amount of work.
It's sort of striking to hear you say it, because a few years ago I tried to do a piece that was like over 40 in Hollywood for women.
And no one wanted to come. This was a
print piece. This wasn't for radio, but literally, even for print, no. Nobody was over 40. It was amazing. Like, not one woman.
And by the way, I'm not either. I don't know why I said that.
That was like different base of numbers that you were using. That's right.
No, that had nothing to do with
it. Something different. But you do something that's just, you know, so exceptional, which is to get into this little teeny club of women who make commercial films. And I was reading my colleague, Seth Abramowitz, who did a cover with you for The Hollywood Reporter. And this was, you were doing, I guess, Pitch Perfect 2. And he said the only people who he could name at that point in the commercial space, women who had made that move, were Betty Thomas and Penny Marshall, which is a historic reference. It's not something contemporary. I mean, they're both great. Hats off to both of them, but not like from the last, what number of years? I don't even know. So that's amazing. You set about very deliberately becoming a director, and you start out, I guess, by watching.
Yeah, I started out on sets watching. I was encouraged really early on by just moments that I had on set. I remember being on the set of Spider-Man with Sam Raimi and watching him set a shot. And I thought, if it were me, I would do it like this. And then he set the shot exactly how I would have done it. And I thought, I might know something.
I might be able to do this.
I have some knowledge, maybe. That was a good instinct, I think. And so I was doing that very quietly. Yeah, and then I did. I set out to be a director, and I took as many opportunities as I could to direct things. And if it meant making a video for Funny or Die, I made a video for Funny or Die. And I directed, you know, little shorts. And I had a really great first experience with the Farrelly brothers, actually.
Movie 43, which I admit I had not heard of, but
that's
you directed a chapter of it.
I did. I directed a chapter of Movie 43 because when the Farrellys came to me and said, will you be in one of them? Here's all the people that are writing, directing these really funny short films that we're going to put together into this sort of anthology. And there were no women directing or writing any of the shorts. And I don't know the Farrellys that well, but I know them well enough that I felt comfortable saying to them, guys, come on. You got to have a woman write or direct one of these. And how about it's me? I said, I won't pressure you into it. I'll pitch you 5 ideas. And if we like one together, maybe you'll let me do it for you. And I went to a female writer, Elizabeth Wright Shapiro, and she wrote a short. We did pitch them 5 ideas. We loved one of them in particular that they also came to love. And I cast some friends and Chloe Grace Moretz, and then made it. It's called Middle School Date, and it actually totally captures the spirit of the movies that I'm now making as well. It's very commercial, it's female-centric, and it's about a girl on an after-school date with a 13-year-old boy, and she gets her period, and all the boys have no idea what to do.
Right, which is, nothing has changed, I'm sure.
Nothing has changed.
Coming up after a short break, Elizabeth Banks weighs in on Kevin Sujihara's departure from Warner Brothers and tells us why Charlie's Angels was ready for a reboot. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to actress, director, and producer Elizabeth Banks, who executive produced the new Hulu series, Shrill. Loosely based on the Lindy West memoir of the same name, Shrill stars SNL's Adi Bryant as Annie, who's struggling to find her voice as a writer at a Portland alt weekly. Her editor, Gabe, played by John Cameron Mitchell, is not feeling her ideas.
If I could just give you a quick pitch. I heard about this pool party, and it's all about people feeling comfortable in their own skin.
The last thing we need is everybody feeling comfortable in their own skin. That would be the 70s.
In 2012, Banks was a producer on Pitch Perfect, a surprise hit that made more than $115 million worldwide on a $17 million budget. Banks also played Gail, a commentator for the ICCA. That's the International Championship of Collegiate A Cappella, of course.
So true, John. Nothing makes a woman feel more like a girl than a man who sings like a boy.
Naturally, Universal was on board for a Pitch Perfect sequel, and Banks was set to produce and reprise her role. But then there's no director suddenly for Pitch Perfect 2.
That's right. Jason Moore, who directed the first movie, declined to come back to direct the second movie. And
we know why. I mean, I'm just curious.
Well, I know why, but I would let him tell that story. That's his story.
We'll talk about that mistake. Okay.
Well, he was getting ready to do Sisters with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. So he had a lovely job. But when that happened, you know, I will say I had a lot of support also from Universal. Donna Langley had seen a short film that I had made for the American Heart Association called Just a Little Heart Attack.
A PSA. I read about it. You play a woman and direct yourself. She's so busy, she doesn't know she's having a heart attack.
Correct. And it has literally saved lives. I have met women who have told me, I saw this short and it made me realize that I might be having a heart attack and et cetera. So I'm very, very proud of it. And I got an award for making it at a Women in Hollywood event. And Donna Langley was at the event and saw the film.
She's the chairman of Universal.
She's the chairman of Universal. And
Film studio.
She saw the film and called me and said, I didn't realize you were wanting to be a director. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm just starting out, but I'm doing little things here and there. And I'm looking for a script. And, you know, and then, you know, 6 or 7 months later, the job for Pitch 2 opened up and they sort of called me and said, we're thinking, you know, now that Jason's not going to do it, that maybe we should hire a young female director to do it. And I thought, I'm so glad you think I'm young. And then off to the races we went.
So you had said that in terms of the kind of film that you can get to yes with, that you think that female-led films are easier to get to yes with for a female director.
For me, I have found that to be true, yes. I was actually told by a big male producer that he didn't think men would follow me.
I was wondering about that.
And I didn't take it totally as an affront in the room, of course. I just tried to educate him on all of the men I have worked with and all of the men that I love and respect. And actually, I thought he was wrong. And I, of course, know him to be wrong because I've directed a bunch of men now.
Right. You have proved it.
And it's gone fine.
Right.
But there are just certain things that certain Hollywood producers take as facts. And, you know, we have to work to educate them against those non-facts, you know.
Right.
It's a process.
We hope.
Hopefully. I think that as a producer, you're always looking for the right combination of people to tell a story. I mean, I'm doing that too. We did that with Shrill. You know, we have this incredible memoir by Lindy West. Who should adapt it? And then who should play her? And you are looking for the absolute best collaborators. And so, you know, it's the same in the movie business. You're just looking for the people that you want to tell the story, the people that you know will stay passionate about the story over time, because film especially takes a long time to get up and running. And, you know, I'm very passionate about female-led stories, which isn't to say that I wouldn't be passionate about a story about a male character. There's many. I mean, I would direct an Indiana Jones right now, you know. I would love the opportunity. I just think that people just in general think to themselves, well, who's the best person to tell this story? Who's going to stay connected to it? I also find, though, that they don't totally do that on the other side.
They really don't.
Like, no one questions it when a guy directs women.
Nope.
But I have, to my face, been questioned about directing men.
Yes, I had a bad feeling that was likely to be the answer. So now you brought me to Shrill, which when you are producing something like Shrill, and meanwhile you're prepping Charlie's Angels to shoot and whatever else, I don't even know the list, you know, what do you do? How engaged do you get?
You have to be pretty engaged. My television deal is through Warner Brothers, and they have an expectation of their producers, whose overhead they cover, to be engaged. You know, Shrill worked in this way, in that your main job as a producer is to find the stories to tell. So it's figuring out what stories to tell and then connecting the right people to that story and plugging people into all the jobs. And so the memoir came to us And we loved it. The Lindy West memoir, Shrill. Mm-hmm. We met Lindy. We totally hit it off. I mean, I was almost begging her to let us work on the movie at that point. I mean, the show at that point. And I sort of said to her, again, this goes into the category of things I say and then try to do. I said, I have just worked with Adi Bryant, which I had on SNL, and I think that she should play you and we should go for this and we shouldn't shy away from any of the issues in the book and we should put abortion in the show and all of that. And then we got lucky because Warner Brothers also has a deal with Ali Rushfield, who is an incredible writer. So we sent it to her kind of as a fluke, like, let's hope she likes it. And then she also really liked it. So now, okay, now we have the memoir. Now we have the writer.
You've already got Adi Bryant in mind.
I have Adi Bryant in mind. She was already loving the memoir and kind of hoping that we were considering her, which we were. And then I had a couple phone calls with her. And then I remember I took her to dinner and basically kind of like roped her into it then. And that's when they put together the pitch and we just shape it. We get it ready to go and sell it. Then we go out. Then we have to sell it. We sold it to Hulu. I mean, these are all the steps of the
right.
producing.
Did you pitch it all over the place? Or did
we did. We had a few offers on it, which is always great. But Hulu knew that 80s. Schedule, if we wanted the show on the air sooner rather than later, that we had to go right away. And so they gave us a production commitment for her hiatus last summer, and we were able to make the show.
I'll ask you a question that may slightly put you on the spot, but you're a Time's Up person.
Okay.
You're at Warner Television.
Uh-huh.
We ran a story just very, very recently about Katie McGrath.
Yes.
Saying that there was a values issue. Mm-hmm. That's my story about Kevin Sugihara. So mm-hmm. I was paying attention. And it's also my story about Katie McGrath. I mean, what do you think make of that? Saying that J.J. Abrams' deal, Bad Robot, may go elsewhere.
Yeah.
If this executive who had been essentially pushed out for a scandal.
Yes.
Was still there.
Great for Katie McGrath. First of all, she's an incredible advocate for Time's Up and for women in Hollywood. And I think that that's the way that you conduct business. When you actually do want to stand for something and the people who are paying your bills don't stand for the same thing. I mean, that's something we're seeing all across Hollywood. As a business decision for Bad Robot, they're absolutely allowed to decide the type of people that they want to work with.
I'm just shook because the power of that is so unmistakable.
That is power.
So Charlie's Angels. Mm-hmm. Your idea?
Well, I believe Aaron Spelling came up with the idea.
Okay, I stand corrected. Yes. I forgot about him.
Let's not take too much credit.
Yeah.
Rebooting Charlie's Angels in this way, in the way that I wanted to do it, yes, that was my idea. Expanding the world beyond sort of three women on a beach in Malibu.
Right.
You know, the thing about Charlie's Angels was that it is by its nature a story about women at work. That's the DNA of Charlie's Angels. And so I was able to work on a really big canvas, a big action canvas, but still tell a movie that fronts women. And that kind of opportunity does not come along. You have to make that opportunity. That movie was sitting there, that franchise, that IP was sitting there because no man is thinking about directing that. And, you know, what a great opportunity for me. So I really like telling big stories. I like making commercial movies. I'm not as interested in the sort of, you know, indie play at this moment in time, but everything can change. I mean, I don't say no to anything.
You're right. You're young, remember?
I'm so young.
You were specifically told that. Elizabeth Banks is the executive producer of Shrill, now on Hulu, the director of the forthcoming Charlie's Angels movie, and producer of many projects in development. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.